friends are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. I am so delighted, Andy, to welcome the Minister of State for the Diaspora and International Development. Welcome, because for a couple of reasons, not the least of which, you're from west of the Shannon. You're a neighbour in County Galway, and Ciarán Cannon, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Adrian. Delighted to be here. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to have this conversation with you.
Obviously, there are several issues that we face here without ever looking, not looking to Ireland at all. And we may have a good ending to it. We're hopeful that at least we seem to be moving in the right direction. And that's easy to define if we were expecting nothing but hell and damnation. So, but that's our side. Can you, first of all, tell us about your appointment?
Sure.
Your role.
Yeah, it's a fascinating role, Adrian, and one that I'm really excited about. I'm in the job now almost 4 months, and when our newly elected Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was making the calls on that fateful morning, many of us were sitting by the phone waiting for the phone to ring, and thankfully at 20 to 9 on a Tuesday morning my phone rang, and I saw it was my colleague Leo Varadkar, and he opened the conversation by saying, "Ciarán, I have some very difficult and some very pleasant calls to make this morning." And then he hesitated ever so slightly. And then he said, "This is one of the pleasant ones. So I want to appoint you as Minister for the Diaspora and for International Development." And I was hugely honoured and feel hugely privileged to be the representative of our 70 million people worldwide who have that very strong affinity with Ireland and really value their Irishness, to be their voice in the Irish government, to advocate for them, to engage with them and to determine what exactly are their needs now and in the future and how we respond effectively to those needs so that they feel that their lives matter, that their hopes and their aspirations, not alone for themselves, but for their children and grandchildren, matter to us on that little island of Ireland. So it's a fascinating job. And for the first 4 months, I've been really enjoying it immensely. Primarily because when I get out to the US in particular, I see the strengths of the Irish community here. It's really phenomenal. I was in Chicago, Milwaukee about 3 weeks ago. We visited, Gaelic Park, the Irish American Heritage Center in Chicago. We visited the wonderful Milwaukee Irish Fest, 140,000 people over 4 days. And I genuinely mean this, Adrian. We in Ireland could learn a lot from the Irish communities here in the US about how they promote and how they cherish Irish culture, our music, our literature, our theatre. And for me, it was a hugely strengthening experience in terms of what I'm doing. And I came home buoyed up to ensure that the job I'm doing is the best possible job, that I can do it in the best possible way and continue to support the endeavours of those communities across the US and give them the supports that they need. And that's ultimately my role, and not alone in the US, but UK, Australia, South America, all those places where our people were thrown to the four corners of the world, 60, 70, 100 years ago.
Of course, it doesn't hurt that you come from near Athenry, a place that even never heard of Kiltulla, but then many people don't know where Ity Mass is either.
That's true.
over at the foot of the Arts Mountains. But tell us a little bit about yourself and growing up in...
Obviously, coming from the west of Ireland, we have huge experience with emigration, so I would have relatives here in the US and in the UK. I grew up in a tiny little rural community where, in the middle of a time in bog, where we had a wonderful childhood. There were 7 children in my family. My mum was a teacher. My dad worked for Bord na Mona, which had a presence in Atymen and still does to this day. And we... a great childhood, a wonderfully supportive rural community where everyone took care of one another. The spirit of the Mehel was alive and well and still is. I went to school in Kiltulla, where my mother taught for 42 years. So there are advantages and disadvantages to having your mother teaching you. And then we moved on to a presentation college in Athenry and then ultimately to Trinity in Dublin. And before, I'm involved in politics now since 2004. I was first elected to Galway County Council in 2004. Before that, I was the CEO of a children's charity in Ireland that cares for children with special needs. Before that, I was involved in local government. So it's been a fascinating journey. I'm 52 years old this week. And hopefully have a lot more to offer in terms, in terms of the politics and the things that I do. So, yeah.
Passion for politics, when the Progressive Democrats, indeed was established, and many would have felt that, that was really, a thorn, and, that was, born out of, a frustration with government. Now, as you as a youngster coming in, you actually know a little bit about youth and politics and being progressive and there. And then, of course, with the when the Progressive Democrats, others better known as the PDs, you joined Fine Gael. Let me ask you about, your role then in Fine Gael. Obviously, you had a great interest in preventing immigration, primarily with training and skills and that type of positive stuff that would stop the bleeding.
Yes. When I was first elected to Dáil Éireann in 2011, the Taoiseach conferred upon me the great honour, the great privilege of being appointed as a junior minister in education with a specific role in skills development. Ireland was in a horrendous place at the time. Mm-hmm. We had almost 16% unemployment. But we felt somewhere deep down that if we worked with the Irish people in restructuring and redesigning our economy, that we could move to a point where we would have full employment once again. And now, 6 years later, we're almost there. But the challenge we were looking at in terms of skills development was that if we were looking at bolstering and enhancing Ireland's role in technology, in food science, in pharmaceuticals, in all these new industries of the 21st century, we had to ensure that our children had the skills to play their part in those industries. And there was a bit of a skills gap there. Now, that wasn't unique to Ireland. That existed across the whole of the EU and still does to a certain extent in some countries. But we needed to restructure FOSS, which was our national training authority at the time, to ensure that the courses they were delivering to our young people were bang up to date, were really relevant in terms of giving those young people a chance to secure. Once the recovery began in terms of industrial investment, and we've seen huge investment from US companies in Ireland, that they had the skills to take part in that. So we needed to restructure FOSS to consolidate, rationalise it to a certain extent. And then we created a structure whereby our education and training boards in each region, in Galway, in Cork, in Limerick, in Dublin, in Letterkenny, that they would engage with industry locally and determine what the local skills needs were, not the national skills, the local skills
needs. We might want to define FOSS.
FOSS was our national training agency. It was an agency charged with providing apprenticeship opportunities for Irish young people. Because in most of our young people's career paths, they have principally two options. They finish secondary school or high school, as it's described here in the US, then they either go on to college or they go into an apprenticeship or a training opportunity. And in places like Austria and Germany, it's about half and half. Okay, half the children go one direction and half go the other direction. In Ireland, we have about 65-66% going to college and then the rest going down the apprenticeship route. So we needed to enhance that opportunity and ask parents to consider the apprenticeship route for the children, because we found that not all children succeed in a university environment. They have talents and skills that are not enhanced or in any way developed by a university environment, and they're far better off working in an apprenticeship model. And we needed to bring those apprenticeships bang up to date. So it's about much more than plumbing, than electrician, bricklaying, whatever it might be, carpentry. Yeah. They're all exceptionally important and will always remain so. But there were other apprenticeship opportunities that we needed to develop to feed into the medical devices industry, the pharmaceutical industry, to developing our food science opportunities. So all of these things were coming down on top of us in terms of the skills gap, and we decided to sit down, redesign FOSS and rename it and restructure it. It's now called SOLACE, and also build
Gaelic word for light.
For light, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's now has very, very strong links. It's almost embedded in our education and training opportunities all over the country. And we do that research locally in Galway, in Cork, Limerick, Dublin, wherever it might be, to determine what are the industries that are here right now, what's likely to happen in terms of industrial development in the future, and how can we empower each young person in that region to gain the skills that they need to play a part in those industries. So it's a much more lithe, a much more agile organization. Yeah. It reacts much quicker to the industry's needs. It was very slow, too big, too cumbersome, and we've now made it much better, and it's working.
And in no small way has that been responsible for the unemployment from 16% down to 6%. That could not have happened.
There are two key components to getting your unemployment figures down. One is that the jobs have to be created, and that's about, you know, marketing Ireland abroad and the wonderful work that the IDA and Enterprise Ireland do. But the second thing is once you do create the jobs and you invite in the Boston Scientifics and the Microsofts and the Apples and the Googles, that your kids actually have the skills to participate in that investment. Because if they don't, well, first of all, the investment won't come. And then even if it does, they don't have the skills to be involved. And one of the things, if you talk to any of the global CEOs of those tech companies, pharma, med tech companies that are locating in Ireland, and ask them what is the primary reason they're in Ireland, they will say to you, our skills. They'll say to you, it's about our young people, you know, and that's really valuable. And that's something we need to nurture and grow and develop in the future.
There are obviously deep concerns here with respect to the threat of immigrants, all immigrants, not just Irish immigrants, being if not deported, being in a situation that wasn't that threatening before.
Mm.
The Irish government in recent years, and your party, Fine Gael, definitely made a great effort to welcome those who may feel, and rightly so, that there was nothing in Ireland for them. Now they wanted an opportunity, particularly in the United States, since their future was not only not guaranteed, but it didn't look like anything was going to happen. The Irish government invited a lot of immigrants back to Ireland. Mm. I would say that many who were heading back to Ireland were doing so with great reluctance. It was not the, you know, it was not the great emotional pull back to the homeland, but rather
out of necessity,
and a huge disappointment. So when they got, when a lot of immigrants got to Ireland, and particularly since the government says, "Hey, you can come back now. Mm. Our unemployment has settled. We need you, and we're going to take care of you." That has not happened across the board. We, like Northern Ireland, like any political situation we have, our own relationship with, you know, throughout the world, we hear the bad stories. And there are many, I'm sure, who have returned to Ireland and who were, you know, who did have some degree of help from the Irish government, but not an obvious one. Well,
okay.
What are you going to do?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me just say that we value to a huge extent our global Irish worldwide. The very fact that Senator Billy Lawless was appointed to our Senate by Taoiseach Enda Kenny is symbolic of that, that the Taoiseach appointed the first ever minister for the diaspora in Jimmy Dinahan and has continued to allow that role to continue, is indicative of how much we value that relationship. And yes, we are saying to our people worldwide, if you want to come home, please do. We need you back. We are approaching full employment. And we are rapidly approaching a time where, if you want to see your economy growing, we have the fastest growing economy in Europe for the last 4 years running. We need those people with skills, with incredible experience of working worldwide, to come home and play their part in that. When they do come home, there's no question, Adrian, they are facing challenges in terms of simple things, to be frank, most of them quite simple, one would imagine, getting a driving license, opening a bank account, getting perhaps a mortgage for their first home in Ireland, establishing a business in Ireland, getting even a, you know, an ESB account. And all these things, we've been, certainly in my last 4 months, I've been hearing from individuals who email me, and I'm anxious to respond to them, and I do. So what we've done now is we've appointed a very experienced firm of consultants, Indicon, who have huge experience in governmental structures and state structures and how they need to be reformed. And we've said to them, talk to these people and go out and determine why exactly these issues are arising. Talk to each of the individual government departments, talk to the banking federation, talk to the insurance federation, determine what the problems are, crystallize them, tell us what they are, tell us what the solutions are, what we need to do as a government to solve these problems. And they will have their report published by the end of this year. They were contracted to do so about a month ago. And then I'm going to take that document and I am going to work day and night to ensure that any of those issues that are within my power and the power of my colleagues in government to resolve, we will resolve. And any of them that are outside our power, we will work with, for example, the Irish Banking Federation, the Irish Insurance Federation, to ensure that they do their level best to make that move, that transition to Ireland, as smooth and as seamless as possible. Because you're dead right. If somebody makes the pretty momentous decision to take themselves, perhaps their wife, their family, Ireland, their kids, take them out of school and make that journey home, the last thing we want to feel, them to feel, is that they're not welcome, that there's somehow, there are barriers being thrown up in front of them that are, at times, utterly unnecessary, sometimes necessary, but sometimes still too cumbersome to negotiate. So we have an interdepartmental government group where I bring in, around a table, a lot larger than this one, in the Taoiseach's department, representatives from every single department in government to discuss this and this alone. That's our only role. And once that report becomes available, we will be sitting down as a collective group in every department in government saying, here's what Indicon has identified in terms of problems. Now, let's work on solving them. And I will be demanding the solving. If they can be solved, I'll be demanding that they be solved. And I'll be holding people to account to ensure that they are solved.
If we were to take all the people who, in fact, for various reasons, many of them, of course, have are well established here. Many are undocumented. Outside of your control, Ireland and the relationship with Washington has, in fact, it has worked to some degree. Today is a different day, a different age. And as I say, sometimes there's a spark in terms of maybe things might, if by default, maybe get better. We don't know about that. What we do know is that through the decades, Irish government has had a tremendous interest in the diaspora. And I don't think any of us, definitely on our side of the Atlantic, could say that they don't care one way or the other. That is not true. And I think most people realize that, yes, the Irish government is more than interested. I was privileged many years ago to be a member of the task force on the Irish government task force on policy towards immigrants.
Okay.
So the Irish government has done. I don't think, though, that it has ever been as strong as it has in recent years. And I would be, if I may say so myself, under Taoiseach Enda Kenny. There has been anything of a backslapping nature. In addition to putting up government money for immigrant agencies here, the consulates, the Washington has been very supportive, and that sometimes that's, you know, equally, or it's the chicken and the egg. You need both. And that has been, you know, of tremendous help. And you're even now committing to doing more.
We are. First of all, can I just say, in terms of our immigrant support program here in the U.S., I was privileged to speak right now where we are in the consulate in New York last night, and to announce that we're increasing our funding to all of those immigrant Irish community groups here in the U.S. by 20%. So, you know, we are continuing, as our economy recovers in Ireland, and as we have more resources available to us, we will be spending additional resources on supporting our Irish community worldwide. There's no question about that. And I think the symbolism of our intent to extend the vote in our presidential elections again to all of our Irish people worldwide is powerful. And that was driven primarily at first by Enda Kenny, and as our new Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has taken up the baton now, and it's an exceptionally important policy area for him as well, and indeed for our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, who spoke so passionately about it last night. Our Taoiseach repeatedly uses the phrase the global Irish nation, and that's something we want to grow and to develop and give people, no matter where they are in the world, a belief, a sense that they are part of that global, and that Ireland in the future is not going to be confined to a tiny little island on the west coast of Europe, that we are a people of approximately 70 million. We're all over the world, and we now have an opportunity through the use of technology to communicate far more effectively with one another than we did even 10 years ago. So the first thing we're going to do to kind of cement that relationship is to extend the vote in our presidential elections to all of our diaspora worldwide, so that the president will no longer be the president for the 6 or 7 million people on the island of Ireland. He or she will also be the president for every single person around the world who considers themselves to be Irish. And I think that's very powerful. We're going to have a referendum for that, hopefully in the next 36, 48 months. We're going to ask the Irish people for their permission, because constitutionally we're obliged to do so, to extend that vote to their cousins, brothers, sisters, the Irish community worldwide. And I'm very confident we'll win that referendum, and then we will be able to have that very symbolic move to extend the vote to all of our Irish around the world.
And actually, it is internationally, that will be considered to be much more than a symbolic move. Having immigrants having a say in the election of the president of Ireland,
our first citizen, yes,
is huge.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And, you know, you always have to give a strong signal of intent. If you are trying to win the trust and the confidence of the Irish community worldwide, it can't all be one-way traffic. You have to say to them, we firmly believe in the depth and the importance of our relationship with you, and here's one way we can bring that in, you know, make that real, and allow for that vote to allowing for that vote to happen is I think is hugely, hugely powerful. And that then, alongside our continued and increased investment in Irish communities all over the world, our enhanced attempts to engage with our community worldwide, is very much part of my role, and it's an exciting time. And as you say, there's a far greater emphasis on that relationship now than there was even 10 years ago, primarily driven initially by the Taoiseach Enda Kenny, who saw the importance of that relationship, and again now reinforced by our new Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who's continued down the same vein. So it's a very exciting time for Ireland, for the Irish community worldwide, and I think we've an awful lot to learn from. And we had a wonderful event last night where we spoke to the directors and indeed members of the board of our various community centres, Irish community centres here in New York and Philadelphia. Yes. And we sat down for 2 hours and we listened to their daily experiences of supporting and engaging with members of the Irish community here in New York and Philadelphia, the challenges that they face. And we said to them, talk frankly, speak frankly. You tell us what we need to do to make your lives better and to make to support you in the work that you do.
We heard, you know, the newly appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs last night telling us about the advent and the problems that Ireland is having that doesn't have specifically have to do with your area, but it definitely is going to affect your area, and that is Northern Ireland, not great, and Ireland can be very nervous that the clock is ticking and still don't have an assembly. Brexit, again, real, very real, very challenging. Challenging. Can I just revisit for a moment the encouragement that the Irish government has up to now that says, come back, we can use you. Will that, some will consider that to be, that's going to be another consideration whether to move back or not, because we don't know, right now what Brexit, how that's going to affect Ireland. We don't know, you know, obviously, if there is not an elected assembly in Northern Ireland and direct rule comes back to there, how do you measure the stability against the ever-growing investment in Northern Ireland? Despite all of this, you have a great number of the inward investment has never been better.
Never been better, no.
Is it, without, you know, jinxing it, what's your read on why there is this wild interest in Ireland?
Okay. There are some uncertainties, and there are some things that nobody knows in terms of what's going to happen with Brexit in particular. But there are some things we do know. And what we do know is right at the heart of the negotiation process, in terms of the EU, Brussels negotiation with London, in terms of how the UK is going to extract itself from the EU, right at the heart of that process, we have Ireland's interests firmly on the table. And that's been agreed by Michel Barnier, the guy who's heading up the and everybody who's been involved in negotiations between Brussels and Dublin. So every step that is taken to prepare for the UK's exit will be proofed against, is this particular step in Ireland's interest or not in Ireland's interest? And, you know, that's exceptionally important to have that commitment in place, because we are the country going to be most seriously impacted by this exit. We have over €1 billion a week in trade between the UK and Ireland, which is a phenomenal figure. It accounts for that trade accounts for about 10% of all Irish jobs. So, you know, we have to be very, very careful in ensuring that in the Brexit process, those jobs, those trading opportunities are protected to the greatest possible extent. So I'm confident that we have very, very capable people at the helm of these negotiations, including Minister Coveney himself.
Yes.
And I'm equally confident because, as you point out, the investment just keeps coming. I mean, the US over the last 10 years has invested more in our little island on the edge of Europe than it has in Brazil, Russia, India and China combined. So the investment continues to pour in. Even just a month ago in my own city of Galway, Boston Scientific, one of the biggest med tech companies in the world, invested $30 million in a new research facility. We saw LinkedIn in Dublin just 2 days ago announcing another similar investment. There is no reluctance on the part of international industry, international business, to continue believing in Ireland. And that gives me a lot of hope for the future. Why are they continuing to invest in us? Well, first of all, we were remaining and firmly remaining in the EU. When Britain leaves, we will be the only English-speaking country in the EU, a market of 500 million people. We have the skills, we have the very talented young people, and we have a very business-friendly environment. You know, so they're the reasons that the investment continues. And yes, Brexit is going to be challenging. There's no question about that. We have to all work hard to minimize those challenges to the greatest possible extent. But I am very optimistic about the future of Ireland in terms of how the international investment will continue. And also, there's a significant amount of growth beginning to happen now in our own indigenous industries, who also account for hundreds of thousands of jobs. In fact, we have now more people employed in Ireland than any time ever before. So, you know, it's positive. Yes, we need to be careful that we minimise the challenges of Brexit. We do have incredible support from our European partners in doing that. They acknowledge that Ireland is the most vulnerable in this process, and they're working to, as I said, minimise the damage to the greatest possible extent.
Despite the instability in Europe and the advent of Brexit, one thing that we're inclined to, maybe it's in our character, but we say, you know, with great ease, that Ireland, the fastest growing economy in Europe, and if we were to say much more than that, it would sound like maybe we were bragging. But that is
the truth.
Yeah.
The truth of it. And this time around, this is the interesting thing, Adrian. This time around, that growing economy is built on an exceptionally solid foundation. Because last time around, we had our Celtic tiger, which now it transpired wasn't a tiger at all. It was a little pussycat that fell off the edge of a cliff. But it was built primarily on us selling houses to one another. I mean, there were incredible exchequer revenues coming in, taxation on building 90,000 houses a year that we didn't need. It was an economy based on sand. On quicksand. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Now we have an economy, and in fact we have, one of the challenges we have now is we have very little house building going on, and we've now got to encourage the private sector to begin building houses again just to accommodate our normal growth. But the economy is now built on things we are really, really good at, and we can be good at forever. You know, food. Ireland is a huge agricultural sector. We're the fourth largest exporter of beef in the world. Huge dairy exports. And opening up new markets now in China and the US and the Middle East. We're really good at that. Technology, we're really good at that. Pharmaceuticals, really good at that. Financial services. I mean, we're now seeing a lot of huge financial service concerns moving from London to Dublin because of Brexit. So, you know, if you are careful in building an economy on sectors that are sustainable, and that will grow exponentially over the future, you can say, with confidence, that Ireland's economy will continue to grow, and we will be, you know, very much a major player in Europe in the future. So that's Richard Bruton, who was our first Minister for Jobs in the new government in 2011. That's what he kept saying over and over again. We will re-establish growth. We will re-establish job creation, but we will do it on a sustainable footing, on a solid foundation. And that's what we've done, and that's what we're going to continue to do in the future.
And a Ripley's, believe it or not, has come to the end of our interview here. And let me preface that by saying I'm delighted that you've explained a lot of things. But maybe what we should point out too is that Irish companies in the United States employ almost on par and provide jobs, but the same number, give or take, than American companies in Ireland.
That's very true. And some people are quite taken aback when they hear that statistic, but Irish companies in the US have a huge presence here, and they do employ a very significant amount of people. And that's continuing to happen and continuing to grow, because the world is becoming a very small place. It really is, in terms of communication, in terms of transport. So when you have, and this is something we're also very, very keen on, when you have innovation at the very heart of your economy and your society, and indeed your education system, when you are encouraging your young people to be entrepreneurial, it's inevitable that those very successful fledgling Irish companies are going to emerge. And then when they establish a base in Ireland and they get themselves settled in and they begin to earn revenues, more often than not, the next place they look is the US.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, because of the language, but more importantly, because of the strength of the Irish community here.
Absolutely.
They feel it's our second home, and that, to them, that is a natural progression to move out of Dublin, out of Galway, out of Limerick, over to New York, to San Francisco, Chicago, wherever it might be. So, I expect that to continue to happen, and even more so in the future. So,
great.
It's all very positive.
On a personal level. Tell us about your interest in Ceol, in dance.
I love, Ceol is my passion. My dad worked, as I mentioned earlier, in Bord na Mona.
Yeah.
And he came home every evening at 4:30 for dinner. And he inevitably would say, "Kieran, will you go down to the room and get my accordion? I heard a lovely tune on the radio today." Because they had the radio on in the background at work the whole time. And I would bring up his accordion. I might be only 9 or 10 at the time. And I'd hand him his accordion. And while mum would be finishing getting the dinner ready, Dad would be on his accordion, and by the time dinner was ready, he'd be playing it. He'd be playing whatever tune he had heard, because he had a very good ear for music. And his dad before him was the same. He played at Cayley's, at Crossroads, and Cayley's in people's houses. Mm-hmm. There was no television, no radio, no internet, no newspapers. You know, it was a very simple life. So when I was 4 or 5 years of age, I began to pick up the accordion as well and work out a few tunes. And then I moved on to the piano accordion when I was 12, and then ultimately to the piano. So, look, music is my passion. I adore, I mean, it keeps me sane. I share so many special moments with friends of mine who are all musicians and singers, in Galway in particular. And I have a huge admiration for all of our people who take our tradition worldwide. You know, the incredible musical ambassadors we have, you know. And
just look at Coulter's Kultur.
Coulter's is an extraordinary organization. Yeah. And what's happening is every generation of new Irish musicians take a tradition that stretches back over thousands of years, and they make it their own. They imbue it with new life and new energy. I was in Milwaukee last week, or a couple of weeks ago. I played on the stage, what an honour, with Wee Banjo 3, a phenomenal group of four musicians from Galway, who are each of them virtuoso musicians. But when they come together, they create something very, very special. I got a chance to sit up on a piano with them to 8,000 people in Milwaukee. It was a phenomenal 3 minutes for me. I enjoyed it immensely. I do a bit of songwriting as well for Sean Kane, Dolores' brother,
who
I think right now is one of the most powerful ambassadors for our tradition, both vocally and in terms of he can play pretty much anything. Sean is doing a lot of great work touring in Ireland and America, and indeed in Europe at the moment. I've written a couple of songs for him. One song in particular, a song called Nature's Little Symphony, which was performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra in Stephen's Green with Sean on our 1916 celebrations on Easter Monday last. So music is great. I love music. It keeps me, as I say, well grounded. I get a chance just to play with some friends at home every now and again, and I enjoy it immensely.
I want to thank you. I think we've covered a lot of subjects, but one of the things that I would like to pass on is that even though this is your first trip to New York as Minister
for the Diaspora,
for the Diaspora and International Development, that you bring not just positive news, but I think that a lot of people under tremendous stress here at the moment will again appreciate the fact that you're coming in with guns a-blazing. I want to wish you luck, except that, as you know, we came within a hen's kick of bringing the Sam Maguire to
Mayo.
And we have to beat Galway again next year. Sorry for your trouble. But
I mean, it's been a wonderful year for hurling in Galway. So, I come from the same parish as Tony Keady, who we sadly lost earlier on this year. So hurling means so much to every single household where I live. And it was great to see Liam crossing the Shannon. Last time Liam McCarthy crossed the Shannon, I was 23. I'm 52 now. That's a very long time ago.
I have several reasons for bringing up the Sam Maguire going to Mayo, because we're still mourning about that. But I knew well that you wouldn't let that one go without mentioning it. County Galway. Okay. Well, we'll keep it at that. You know, you can have your hurling. God knows we're going to be no threat to you. It's great. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you so much, Adrian. Thanks for the opportunity to talk to you.
And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.